A5. Number 4B.
All right. Now, can you see that when John Dolly had this first feeling of stating this hypothesis, that first of all, each synonymous term is definitely characterized by ideas which do not belong to other synonymous terms, and second, that there must be definite order of the synonymous term, that he was really stating something big, but which still had to be proved. Now, this is always in any science the great thing, that the genius is that one who can ask the right question. That's what makes up a genius, that he can sense somehow where the problem lies and is not seeking in the other field and where there is no fundamental problem. So at that time he saw that he must find a method to prove his hypothesis, or to see if his hypothesis could stand the critics or not. So nobody knew how to do it, how to prove it from the textbook. Because you must think how it was, that there was a field of perhaps a million Christian scientists reading the lesson sermon and the textbook, who all stated that seven synonymous terms are freely interchangeable. Therefore, they could certainly not give us a method how to prove the very opposite. I say that because finding the method is one of the most important thing and the most difficult thing. To find the answer is easy once you have the right method. So it wasn't a question to find the right answers, just as we today give it to the students. We just give them the seven synonymous term, tell them what the seven synonymous term, what the ideas are, as if this would be the easiest thing on earth. But at that time, it took us years, so to say, to find first the right method to approach the subject. And that method was not so easy to be found as we thought it would be. The method that Mr. Dolly tried out was really a very scientific approach. In any science, you approach a subject like this, that you state first your hypothesis. You state it and you feel this hypothesis may be true. But as long as it is not proved, it remains a hypothesis and not a new theory. When you have stated your hypothesis, then you go to a second step. Namely, you try to test your hypothesis wherever you can test it. Then, by testing it, usually, or practically always, one finds out that that hypothesis may be wrong, has been wrong, or half wrong, or 80% wrong, or something like that. I don't think that there are many great inventions that have been made where that hypothesis could just be proved 100% right away. Usually there is that testing where, and this is then a third stage, where one begins to find out what was wrong about the hypothesis, what was wrong about the method. One finds out the errors one is assuming, or the erroneous procedure one has been taking, and so one begins, as a next step, as a fourth step, to change or to restate the hypothesis. One polishes, so to say, the hypothesis, one gets a clearer hypothesis from which to work out, and goes again through the whole process of testing now the new hypothesis and see if it works, if it's correct, if it's valid or not. And perhaps at the second time one finds out that it's not yet valid 100%, that there is still something missing. And so you go a step further and try to find what was wrong again. And another step, you have a third hypothesis and you word it again anew. And so step by step you come nearer to the final conclusion. Now this is the method of a science, and it's not the method of a religion. The religionist doesn't like that method. The religionist wants to go to the authority, whoever it is, the pastor, the bishop, the pope, or whatever it is, or the Christian Science teacher, and says, here is a question, give me the blunt answer. And he has to have the 100% answer. And then he feels, if I get that answer, that's a fine authority. The scientist doesn't think that way. The scientist always thinks in a way that he goes nearer and 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 feels, I'm never quite there. If he's quite there, then we can know that he's wrong. Because revelation is infinite. Revelation goes on. We have never arrived. We are always on the way. And if we have a feeling we have arrived, then we are no more mature scientists. Then we are just ordinary scientists. Scientists of ordinary science. Because the mature scientist is always willing to take into consideration that there is a higher view, that there is a broader view, that there is something more about the subject than what he knows already. Now, only if you see this scientific method of approaching a subject, you can understand our history, which we went through, and of which I give you further indications, can understand that our method was also that method of trial and error, of approaching the results, the final results, step by step, having to rectify and rectify and rectify our findings constantly until one has arrived at a certain result that where one felt this is solid enough to build further on. That took years and years. So let me show our zigzag way that we have gone. Just think back how the situation was at that time, that we didn't know anything how to study the seven synonymous terms, that there was no method how to study them, that no one knew if it is right that each synonymous term has a different characteristic or not. All this was a hypothesis, and how to find out if it's true. So we started in 1938-39, in that winter. We spent in a little group that John Dolly gathered around himself. There were three teachers at that time and four practitioners and someone else and me as a greenhorn who were in that study group, and we gathered every week on a Saturday from morning to evening and began to study the seven synonymous terms. How? Well, we just tried. And by trying, finding out how to do it better afterwards. We would start and take one synonym at a time. And started with mind, because we knew the definition of God starts with mind. So we felt this is the best way to take just all the references on mind and go right through the textbook from beginning to end, reading now all the statements where the synonymous term mind appeared. So we had first a list of all the mind references. Now you have now that list at the as an appendix of the compendiums. You have that list already. We had to make it ourselves first, or you have it also in John Dolly's book on the science of the pure science of Christian Science. So that work is done. You can take that and build from there. You have there a chronological order of all the references on the synonymous term. So we took the first reference, then the second and the third, and would ask, and this is the great point, we would ask, what does Mrs. Eddy want to bring out that synonymous term, what is the, sorry, I got out of the grammar, to ask each time, how does that reference characterize mind? Now, in order to know what is the characteristic nature of mind, is naturally asking various questions. You can ask now, does this statement say something about what mind is? Say, mind is power, he may say, then you know, mind is characterized by power. Or does that statement say what mind does? That mind heals, for instance, and you know that it heals and you have a characteristic of mind as healing. Or what it has, that mind has intelligence, and you know, mind apparently has to do with intelligence. So you have to ask various questions just to find out, does that statement tell us anything about the nature of mind itself? Of mind itself. Now, if we do that, and we have done that, and every time we found such an answer, that the statement itself, the text itself, would define mind through some idea, some characteristic, we would write out that characteristic, like power or intelligence, and make for ourselves a list as we went along. Now, this sounds very easy. This sounds kindergarten work. But the moment you try to do it, it doesn't seem to be so easy. And there are many reasons why it isn't so easy. So, and before I tell you why it isn't so easy, I just go on in the story. So, actually, if one is honest about that investigation and doesn't try to interpolate our meaning into it, don't interpolate, don't extrapolate, don't change your standpoint, just always ask, what does the text say about mind itself? Not about man's attitude towards mind. That's something very different. See, what attitude we have towards mind, that would describe our attitude and not mind. So we have to be very strict in the analysis, very pure in the analysis, or else we get a list that is incorrect. You agree with that? You get a falsified list. And if one doesn't have a very pure list, one is going to build on a wrong list. What is that list? Concept building. And we would go start out on a false basis, on a false concept building. So this work which we did there was very important, though it was a purely intellectual, analytical work. But Christian Science is intellectual and spiritual. But without first having the letter, the pure letter, the spirit is always wrong. It's always mixed up. We can never have the pure spirit without first having the pure letter. So that work was super important and not easy. And not easy at all. The difficulty was, I would say, that one was putting too much of one's own interpretation into the text. So that instead that the text itself yields its value, one was trying to put something into it because one liked it, or because one thought it should be so, or it might be so. And so at the beginning we had a terrific long list when we finished Mind. Just a terrific long list. And when we did Spirit, we got even more into trouble. When we did Spirit, we would find out that we would find the same, many of the same characteristics that we had in Mind. The very same. When we did Soul and Principle and Life and Truth and Love, we really could feel, well, our hypothesis is not right. Those terms occur in more or less in every synonymous term. So that at that time we would have had to make a great decision, either to say our hypothesis is wrong. It's actually so, what everybody was saying, that the synonymous terms are freely interchangeable, that they have no specific characteristics by themselves. Or we could have done what was unique, to say, I think our method is not good enough. Our method must be changed or must be purified. And perhaps if our method is pure, we may find the answer. I put it forward rather drastically, because it wasn't as drastic as I say it. But this is what could happen, and did happen, only not so drastically, because we began to realize rather soon that our method must take into consideration quite a few rules of thumb, so to say, in order to get at the core of the question. Why did we find, for instance, that each synonymous term would be characterized by power, by law? That you would speak about the power of mind, the power of spirit, the power of principle, the power of life, the power of truth, and the power of love. That you would use law, the law of mind, the law of spirit, the law of soul, the law of life, the law of truth, the law of love. See, this really was the cause, and now one could understand it, that Christian Scientists as a whole would be able to prove literally, from a literal sense, that the synonyms have no specific characteristics. Can you see that? One could really see that they could prove from the text, from the printing ink, that you could say, here Mrs. Eddy speaks about power not as an idea of mind, but as the power of spirit and the power of soul and the power of life and the power of truth and the power of love. Therefore, power has to do with all seven synonymous terms. Now, what we had to learn, and that's where, therefore, the Christian Science movement does not see what we are doing, and why they never arrive at the same conclusions as we do, is that they don't consider something else in that method. Namely, every synonymous term has also its counterfeit. So that when one is studying the synonymous terms, one should also study and make a list of the counterfeits of the seven synonymous terms. You know that the counterfeit of mind naturally would be mortal mind or the human mind or erroneous mind, that the counterfeit of spirit is flesh and matter, the counterfeit of soul would be the testimony of the physical senses or pain or pleasure or sin, etc., that every synonymous term has its counterfeit. Now, the teaching of Christian Science says, if we want to heal a negative problem, then we have to use the exact fact about the problem, and not just any truth. So if the problem is something about the testimony of the physical senses, we know that it has to be dealt with through the fact about which the five physical senses is a lie, namely, the senses of soul. Yes? Which means, and this is not seen, which means that in the textbook, where most of the text is dealing with questions of the human mind and sets questions of the human mind straight, where false opinions, false concepts, false beliefs are presented and set straight, that really the counterfeit rules the use of the synonymous terms, and not the other way around. Did you see that? I repeat it. And afterwards we make exercise on it tomorrow. If Mrs. Eddy writes a textbook on Christian Science, it is all about, mostly about the level of Christian Science and not about the level of absolute Christian Science. She will take up all the questions of is matter or drug a healing power or not, and is there intelligence in matter, is there a sensation in matter, and things like that. She will deal with negative problems. If she has to deal with negative problems, she can only deal with them with using the exact fact about which the problem is a lie. So if she is dealing with the five physical senses, the testimony of the five physical senses, she is not free to use afterwards that life corrects that, or that love corrects that. That which corrects the testimony of the five physical senses are the senses of soul. Yes? Can you see that? So, it's usually, and I must be very exact here, I say usually, because there is a certain percentage in the textbook that has to do with absolute Christian Science, where other rules govern. But usually in the textbook she will deal with a wrong sense, with a wrong sense of prayer, with a wrong sense of the various constituents of prayer, and has to counteract it through the exact opposite of it. And therefore the problem that is stated is the main thing and gives the tone. We call it the subject. The problem stated there in the text is the subject about which she is speaking, and in order to set that right, she must use the right synonymous terms. Okay, so if, for instance, the problem is death, and that death has power, because it seems that nobody can stand against the power of death, that can overrule the power of death, that the power of death is so terrific that each one has to succumb to it. So what is the problem? The problem is stated, death has power. Now, she says, this is not Christian Science. I have to give you an answer to that. to an answer to that belief that death has power. How could we answer that? How can we answer the belief of death? Can we answer that through which synonymous term? What would you say?
Life.
Huh? Life? Not spirit? Not love? Huh? So you have to use life to really be exact. But if the belief is in a secondary way that death is not just death but has power, then if you have to correct that sense through life, then you must say the power of life can offset the power of death. Can you see? That then secondary you say power of life, because the problem is the first thing. It says death has power. So you have to offset it by life being the power. But power fundamentally is mind, as we can prove it afterwards. In other words, can you see something which most people don't realize when they want to study the seven synonymous terms? And the church would like to study. They make terrific effort to study the seven synonymous terms, but they don't know the method and they don't want to listen. The method is very easy. You just have to know a few rules and then you have it. Can you see that we must see that the textbook is written mostly, I would say 95-98%, always in combinations of the seven synonymous terms. Very seldom in its pure tone of the seven synonymous term. Again, I see that you look at me not understanding me. That's nice. That gives me a chance to state it more clearly. Very seldom, say, would the text state that mind is power and mind alone is power and that's that. Therefore, characterizing mind as power. Very seldom. But there are statements. Mostly, that power will be stated in the textbook as combinations with any other synonymous term. The power of spirit, the power of soul, the power of life, the power of truth, the power of love. Can you see? And because we have to read a textbook that is not just like a simple book that always says mind, 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 spirit, 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 soul, 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 but it's Kant is saying, showing a whole symphony, where all the tones always blend. And only here and there the purity of one synonymous term shines through, else always the combinations. Therefore, it's very difficult to find first the right method to separate those combinations and see what is the pure tone of each synonymous term. Do you see that? It's like when we study music, well, we read a symphony. There all the tones are together, up and down, you see. They all come at once. Very seldom there is just a simple melody where one tone in its purity goes to the next tone in its purity. And we feel if that would be the only sense of music, it wouldn't really be very full. We like the symphony. The textbook is a symphony. And to analyze that symphony first, to find out what are the pure tones, that was the difficulty.